Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of the TakeCast. My name is Davis Maddock. You guys can find me on Twitter at Davis Maddock. I am joined by the rare guest on this show who does not use Twitter. You guys know him as Sean Siegel. He is one of the founders of RotoViz, winner of the FFPC main event. Really, to me, the best fantasy football player that that exists in the world. If you have ever played in a league with Sean, if you have ever witnessed one of his drafts, you just get the sense that he understands the game a little bit better than the rest of us. And this conversation is mostly just Sean educating me and the listeners of the TakeCast on how to best approach all of the rookies coming in the 2020 draft class, how to structure your dynasty teams, some dynasty strategy, some redraft strategy, just really a masterclass from Sean. So I hope that I hope you guys enjoy this. I had a great time recording it. If you want to support the show, you can subscribe on patreon.com/TakeCast, and you can also just go ahead and leave a rating or review on iTunes, Google Play, wherever you listen to podcasts. That's very helpful and useful as well. So let's go ahead and get into the episode with Sean. All right, everyone, welcoming in my longtime buddy, Sean Siegel. You guys probably know him as at the FF Contrarian on Twitter, though he very wisely chooses not to use that medium at all. I think that is certainly a very intelligent decision. Sean, how are you enjoying rookie draft season?
It's been fantastic. I think that the NFL draft had a number of very frustrating things that happened, but it's thrown this rookie draft season into absolute chaos and flattened out both the first round and the second round. So I think this allows us a lot more opportunity to make moves, to get the guys you want, to employ different sorts of tactics. And so simply from a tactical perspective, I think that this rookie draft may be the most fun we've ever seen. Is that kind of how you feel having started the process as well?
That is for sure how I feel. There are guys that you are excited to be picking in the fourth round. There are guys you expect to get, 120 PPR points in the second round. There are a load of Rorschach test tight ends. There are quarterbacks like Jalen Hurts and Jordan Love who are really interesting equations in Superflex leagues where, they're not going to be starting right away, but their team spent a ton of draft capital on them. So we expect them to be selected. We expect them to be valuable assets in Superflex for a long time. So I think a great way to start, I was just chatting with Patrick Corain and Peter Overzet right before I hopped on the show, and they had a question that they wanted to hear you discuss on air, which was, they have played in leagues with you for a long time, and they kind of wanted to hear your thought pattern behind consistently giving up, kind of premium veteran assets to just almost always be trading back into rookie drafts.
It's interesting they mentioned that. That's definitely what I like to do. I do find in some ways that it's become harder and harder as I think drafters are getting more used to the idea that these young players, they can come in and contribute. They do have more trade value going forward. Pat himself has done, I think, one of the best series that we've ever had on the RotoViz website talking about draft or trade value and how that progresses through the course of a player's career. And, one of the things that you see is that 24, 25-year-old running backs, they're already cratering in terms of what the trade value is. So even if you're lucky enough to have, say, an Ezekiel Elliott as opposed to a Leonard Fournette or a Todd Gurley, even in that situation, you are staring at trade value potentially bottoming out in any given season. And so if you have guys who are at their peak value, and we talk a lot about sort of aging curves, and one of the things that you see with that is that certainly if a player stays completely healthy, then there is a chance that they will have a good career in their late 20s. Certainly for some wide receivers and the very rare running back, you're going to have some nice production even from 30 to 35, but the trade value there is going to be very minimal, right? And in order for us to to continue to have the types of dynasty teams we want, which is deep and true dynasty, is not a situation where we have one championship window and then, you know, 4 or 5 years of rebuilding, because the rebuilding is tricky if your team gets a little bit older, because people are simply not going to take those players off of your hands for anything meaningful. So you have to play it out, or you have to completely strip down. If you're constantly trading back into the drafts, even if you give up some good players, I've had trades where I've given up Le'Veon Bell a year or two before his value started to fall. I've had trades where I gave up DeAndre Hopkins very early. And certainly I think that you could make the case that he's been one of the two or three most valuable players in Dynasty, over this entire period. But even in those situations, you do tend to get a lot back. Some of those players will bust. But as you continue to cycle through, you end up with teams that are very deep, very powerful. You can trade even a lot of the busts. You can trade after their rookie seasons and get value back. And one of the things that I've experienced, and I would guess that other people have as well, is that I do get wins with my very best, most powerful teams. But I also have upset losses in the semis or the finals. And if you just have that pointed at that one season, your chance at being disappointed is very high. Whereas certainly I think we've all had experiences too, where maybe a team that snuck in to the quarterfinals then got hot and carried it on through. My Kitchen Cinco team last season was in a situation where Barkley didn't contribute much through the course of the season, sneaks into the playoffs, and then all of a sudden with him and McCaffrey go on a run, get into not just the league finals, but then the four-team Super Bowl out of the four divisions there. And because of a miracle performance by Tyler Boyd and, of all people, Andy Dalton, goes on to win. And so that you can only have that if you are constantly in the playoffs with all of your teams. You need to have all of those shots. And so that's why I like to do it. The other thing is just that it's fun, right? I mean, there's nothing more fun than making as many picks as you can in rookie drafts. So I think it accomplishes both things there in terms of both building your team and just pure entertainment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that probably the best way I could explain that theory from the way it works in practice is that right now, Ezekiel Elliott is a consensus first-round pick in startup drafts. That is true for Superflex. That is true for non-Superflex. But go ahead in a league where you have Ezekiel Elliott and try to trade him. Try and trade him for Kyler Murray in a Superflex league. Try and trade him for DJ Moore in a Superflex league and get, some kind of pick back or whatever. Basically, you are just not going to get that equivalent value from a 25, 26-year-old running back. Whereas, I think that there is a reasonable case that you could try and trade Ezekiel Elliott for Jonathan Taylor right now, and the person holding Jonathan Taylor would tell you no.
Definitely. I still have, well, after the draft, pre-draft, I think I had them identical. Actually, Taylor a couple spots ahead. Didn't necessarily care for that landing spot either, sort of as we talked about. Although long-term, it could be fantastic for him. It's really more maybe the other guys on that depth chart who get completely crushed. But yeah, I mean, have Taylor up that high. And certainly I would prefer to have Taylor than Elliott right now.
Yeah, I don't even think there is a case otherwise. So let's get into the meat of it here. Our favorite offense in the NFL, the Kansas City Chiefs, selected Clyde Edwards-Helaire with pick 32 of the NFL draft. And we don't need to debate the value to the real team, but just how high up your dynasty rankings has he gone now as a result of landing in Kansas City? I don't know if it is even possible to be over enthusiastic about his prognosis in Kansas City right now.
This is one of the craziest ones, because I really didn't think that he was one of the top four backs in this draft. And so, I had him at sort of the edge of the top 100, and after the Chiefs draft him and after they say that he's better than Brian Westbrook, and knowing what they plan to do, this offense should have a lot more passes to the running back in the future, perhaps not 2020. It could be a little bit dicey in that season. And then certainly, you have the ever-present specter of injuries, but look at what he could accomplish 2021 through 2023. The three seasons of monster performance, running back 7, like you mentioned, That's exactly where I have him. I have him behind the big five, and then I still have him behind Jonathan Taylor. I'm guessing maybe you have Miles Sanders in there instead. But I mean, he jumps like 80 spots. He jumps up into the 20s overall, and the sky certainly seems to be the limit. This is one of those, I think, only situations where it almost doesn't matter if the Chiefs ended up making kind of a bad reality pick. The floor is so high and the situation is so good that, I mean, he's going to be a fantasy force.
Yeah, I mean, he is, even if he doesn't get 250 carries, you know, he is going to be a very influential part of the passing game. He is going to get a ton of goal line work, you know, kind of in the way that Kareem Hunt got a ton of goal line work. And it's just, it's not even going to particularly matter to me if Clyde Edwards-Helaire is good, just, you know, the same way that I never argued that Damian Williams was, you know, this ever-present talent. I mean, I did think Damian Williams was a good NFL running back, but I never would have been like, oh, well, this guy is as good as Ezekiel Elliott or whatever. That was never the argument, just that the by nature of being the lead running back for the best offense in football, you know, Patrick Mahomes is only 24 and Travis Kelce is 31. Kelce's role as a goal line threat and as the short yardage guy, you know, they throw him a ton of screens and everything. That's going to kind of weed out as Travis Kelce ages. And I think that there are some similarities in areas of the field where you would expect Travis Kelce and a running back to be used. So just kind of, to me, sky is the limit for CEH.
Yeah, and I think, you know, worst case scenario, you're looking, well, not worst case scenario, there are a lot worse cases than this, but one of the very realistic scenarios is something like what Austin Eckler did last year for the Chargers, and, you know, you're looking at 300 fantasy points, so you would take that all day.
Yeah, you definitely would. Okay, so another favorite of ours, CeeDee Lamb, selected at pick number 17 in the NFL draft. I've heard some chatter that people maybe think that the Dallas Cowboys is not a good landing spot for CeeDee Lamb. I think the exact opposite is true. I think you are wanting an elite prospect like Lamb to go to the best possible situation. How are you going to find a better situation than being attached to Kellen Moore and Dak Prescott for the next 5 years?
It would be hard pressed, I think, to find a better situation until you look at the depth chart. So then the question really is, how do you value these guys? And one of the sort of central elements for me is that I think it's actually a little bit easier to make simple choices on who are the big time talents than to try and predict what an NFL offense is going to do, you know, what their role is going to be season to season, game to game, how these players are going to be used, how they're going to fit on the depth chart, trying to make decisions about, well, what is the NFL target share going to be? Now, going through all of those exercises will give you a lot of information about the different players, how you want to order your board. It's certainly not that you don't do those types of things, but beyond that, I think it's simply a matter where you want the best players. And CeeDee Lamb for me is that. And so when you look at what happens for him with this group, I think the damage is more to Cooper and more to Gallup than it is for Lamb, who I could see being the number one there very, very quickly.
Yeah, I actually think that what this pick portends is that Amari Cooper is not long for the Dallas Cowboys, that there are outs in his contract essentially that you know, make it so that after the next 2 years he can be no longer a member of the Dallas Cowboys for I think it's only like $6 million of dead cap room at that point. And I think, I mean, obviously wide receiver was actually a position of need for Dallas, because behind Amari Cooper and Michael Gallup they had Devin Smith, Cedric Wilson. You know, these guys are very fringe NFL players because Randall Cobb left. So, you know, I don't see any way, you know, that this can be viewed as a negative for Lamb. How high do you have him in your dynasty rankings now?
He would still be in that four range for the rookies. I think super flex wise, you're probably looking at Burrow and then Taylor and Edwards-Helaire. But then immediately after that, I think you have to be switching back to Lamb, and you know, Cooper probably drops from the 18 to 30-ish range. I think Gallup drops from the 67 to 84-ish range. Those are the moves that I made when I updated yesterday. Certainly, I don't think you're going to go wrong, though, if you continue to buy those players, because, you know, we don't know just how big this pie could be. And without a lot of peripheral targets, you mentioned how the targets really could be mostly to those three guys. If, you know, Prescott throws for 5,000 yards, this team really lights the world on fire. You know, if he has 40 touchdowns, then all three of those guys could end up being values to the to their owners for, again, maybe 2020 is a little bit weird, but when we're looking to 2021, and one of the things, too, specifically I think about this rookie class, is that when we look at the running backs and where they went, and the reason that you would take running backs in your rookie draft as opposed to the wide receivers, you really want that instant impact. Well, with perhaps not having the exact same offseason this year, and then certainly with those guys all landing in weird situations, we may not get the year one return that you would like to see. And even then, when you think of some of the best guys from the last couple of classes, you think about Nick Chubb, you think about Miles Sanders, and where their production came in their rookie seasons, you move that back another week or two, and really as rookies, they're not helping you very much. And so when we're looking to 2021 anyway with so much of this, I think you have to really move those receivers up compared to the elite running backs in this group.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the guys that you are maybe expecting elite production at the running back position, I mean, for me, it might only be Clyde Edwards-Helaire. You know, we might not get to see that immediate production from Jonathan Taylor, but I think that a lot of people are placing a ton of value that maybe is unjustified for J.K. Dobbins, for Cam Akers, even for, you know, Keyshawn Vaughn. You know, Keyshawn Vaughn is a huge Rorschach prospect because he was a third-round pick in the NFL draft. He was not necessarily regarded as some sort of, you know, freak athletic producer. He was a transfer in college. You know, a lot of reasons to believe that Keyshawn Vaughn is not a blue-chip NFL prospect. He's going to sneak into the back end of the first round in some dynasty rookie drafts. There are people who are very high on him in the Tampa Bay offense. What is your current position on Keyshawn Vaughn?
Well, I'm very high on him as well. This is certainly a dream landing spot. But the other thing I think is that simply, for me, I think it has to make you higher on Ronald Jones, because there were a ton of scenarios where he hits one of those truly elite prospects, or at least the players who have been billed as elite prospects throughout this draft process. To get a guy here who has those limitations that you talked about is perfect for him, right? So I think you have to move both of those players up. Now, Vaughn is somebody I liked and had a lot of before the draft, so it's not someone where I'm completely skeptical. I mean, he was number two from the class in breakaway rushes behind Jonathan Taylor. That's actually something that does have some predictive value. He was at number four in terms of backfield dominator rating. Again, something that will help you beat draft position. So there were some encouraging things about him. It does worry me a little bit if the one thing people are really holding on to is this idea that he's going to pass block better than Ronald Jones, because again, you have that rookie adjustment, and you have something that it's not related to his pure running ability or even his pure receiving ability. Certainly, I would like to think that that's going to be the thing that really elevates these guys, and that while pass blocking can be something that is going to be difficult to coach in the same way that a lot of these other things where people are just like, oh, you know, get in there, he's a pure athlete or he's a great athlete, just then coach him up. Well, that's going to be easier said than done. You know, you certainly have players who are big and athletic and very good at other things, like Adrian Peterson, for example, who never really got to be anything in terms of a pass blocker. So it's not just a matter of saying, oh, well, Ronald Jones will finally get there. But I do think we want to make sure that we're remembering what these guys are as runners. And Ronald Jones, you know, still young, still very, very fast. Someone who in the passing game can take that second down screen pass and go 70 yards. So I don't think that necessarily his receiving volume goes to zero by any stretch. When we're looking at the prospects, I like both guys, but I think we want to make sure we keep Keyshawn Vaughn sort of in perspective there. There's certainly a place in drafts where he's clearly overvalued now.
Yeah. I think another thing about that situation is there are clearly, I think, some tail risks with that offense, which is, I mean, and the biggest one, and I would assume that this would be a larger talking point, but it really hasn't been. But, you know, it, we might get to a situation, a position where Tom Brady is just not an above average NFL quarterback anymore. I don't think that's the most likely outcome. I don't think that that makes a huge portion of the range of outcomes, but I do think that is something that you have to think about when you're deciding how much you want to value Keyshawn Vaughn, where you want to take him in rookie drafts.
Certainly. And a lot of this depends too on if some of the moves that they've made will make that Tampa Bay offensive line good enough to support the runner. Certainly Ronald Jones, Peyton Barber were having to deal with a lot of defenders in the backfield last year. You know, when you have that ability to go 70 yards on any given play, you'll see that a lot more if you can get at least occasionally through the offensive line a little bit unmolested. It's hard to get those jets really going when you have to make three guys miss in the backfield. You know, you mentioned Tom Brady, and certainly we saw what Peyton Manning did with the Broncos, both the good and the bad, and how he certainly lifted them to the Super Bowl at one point, and then at the very end, they're really having to hold him up. We don't know for sure where Tom Brady is going to be in that progression. The 2019 Patriots were a team that's very difficult to read in terms of how much he was helping, how much he was hurting. Did he leave because he really wanted to leave, or did the Patriots feel like he was on the verge of holding them back? Certainly a lot of people have theories about that. I think that he's going to have a good season. I have him in a lot of super flex leagues and certainly want to have another year or two of big production there. I think the offense is going to be good, but like you said, there's certainly some risk.
Yeah. So I think there is a really interesting group of rookie wide receivers, you know, so this is after the CeeDee Lamb tier, after Jerry Jeudy, after Justin Jefferson, after Jalen Reagor. You know, I think those guys, and even to a certain extent, you know, I am very high on Laviska Shenault as well. I sort of feel as if, you know, these guys' resumes are sort of impeachable. And that is T. Higgins, Michael Pittman, Chase Claypool, and Denzel Mims. These are big-bodied guys who have, you know, there would be some reasons that you could doubt their profiles. For Higgins, it's that he's pretty slow. For Pittman, it is age, late breakout, same for Claypool. And for Mims, it was that when he was playing with another NFL player, Jalen Hurd, he basically was relegated to a secondary weapon. And then when he was not playing with Hurd, he seemed more like a guy who was projected to be in the NFL. So, you know, kind of what we know about hit rates suggest really only two of these guys are likely to become big time NFL players. Where are you at on this group of players? And do you think that there is something, you know, that we can point to that says this guy is more likely to be a breakout, or this guy is more likely to be a bust at the NFL level?
Yeah, these guys are interesting. You know, you mentioned the similarities looking at them in the wide receiver prospect lab, and we have them very close once you use the draft positions as well in there. You have Pittman at 84th percentile, Higgins and Mims 80th, Claypool at 78. And then, you know, you mentioned how these are some big guys and can contribute some of that kind of thing to their team. We bring up our freak score rankings. Claypool at 91, he's up there in that DK Metcalf category that very, very few wide receivers ever get to. Certainly still a ways back from Calvin Johnson there at 100, but there's a big gap down to everybody else. You have Mims at 72. You have Pittman at 70. And those are good scores in and of themselves. So like you said, big guys, decent production. I guess in looking at it, that I think one of the things that jumps out to me is that Claypool, and you and I were just in a draft going yesterday, and I was able to draft him in the middle of the third round in Superflex. I really like that value compared to the other players, in that you have this guy who's the best athlete. You have a guy who had a similar final season to the rest of the group there. And you have the situation in an offense that has generated some big numbers for wide receivers. Now, that quarterback situation may change early enough in his career that we shouldn't give that too much weight in terms of dynasty. But again, we want these guys to come in, score some points, retrade them. I think that Claypool would be the guy based on cost who I'd really be targeting right here. Higgins maybe is the one who worries me a little bit, because he has that lower career yardage market share. And those guys who drop down into that 23% range have a lot more risk to them. I think that this Bengals offense while you know, reports are that he'll start right away, despite them appearing to have that trio of exciting or at least intriguing players. You have the rookie quarterback. You know, you mentioned about some of maybe the outside risks, some of the less likely scenarios, but scenarios we have to take into consideration. I do think that there are some very small red flags on Burrow, and even if not, you're having to deal with a little bit of that transition. So in terms of how people are going to score early on, what their risks are, what their costs are, those might be the guys that jump out for me. I know that a lot of our writers, myself included, a lot of our readers are very high on Denzel Mims. Is he somebody you would be very excited about from this group of four?
So the sort of the way I think about Denzel Mims is that he was a guy that I just absolutely would have loved in like 2014, 2015, right? When we first started RotoViz and so much of our focus was on athleticism and, you know, young production, right? So he produced very young. I think one of the things that we have done a great job learning about wide receivers now is that a lot of the function of these guys is just, did you come out of school early? Were you able to come into the NFL a year early? If so, you know, and if you didn't, why, what was the result of that? So I really like Mims's profile as a whole. I think the issue that I am having with it is why did he not come out, right? Why did he not come out after his junior season? And I do not have a good answer for it.
It's certainly difficult anytime that you have your big campaign as a sophomore, because those guys who have that season have a little bit of a fall off. It's almost unfair to some of those prospects. They have, you have to get draft eligible. And so, you know, it really changes what you're looking at in terms of that. As you mentioned, the numbers, we talk about them in the DCC rookie guide, between people who come out early and stay for the 4 years are just dramatic. You know, you get outperformed by a full round in draft position in terms of those two qualities. And so certainly anybody who's there for 4 years, and that's one of the reasons why in the draft yesterday at sort of the Pittman slot, I traded back, because he wasn't someone I wanted to have with that profile there. And so I think those are the red flags for these guys. And that's one of the reasons too that I like Claypool, because if you're going to pick that profile, I do want it to be at a discount, or at least at a price that's not going to hurt you very much. It's also the reason that a couple of these guys who I think maybe there's a little bit less of an emphasis on and are being drafted in a similar range but have a much higher upside, like Chenault or someone we're going to talk about here in a second with a very different athletic profile, size profile in Hamler, but somebody I think who may end up being undervalued as well.
Yeah, and Claypool is a guy that I love. I think there are clearer explanations for why he was not as productive earlier on in his career. You know, this is just something that, you know, it's useful to know school profiles. And a lot of times we see this happen with Notre Dame players, as they have like a very clear hierarchy of how they distribute touches amongst their players. So because I like Claypool's profile so much, maybe I am creating some excuses for him, but I do. I think that he is going to be great. I think that the Steelers are an organization that is good at identifying wide receiver talent, so we should trust that a little bit. So moving on now, a different organization. The Broncos are all in on Drew Lock. They draft Albert O, his former college teammate. They spend a first-round pick on Jerry Jeudy, and they add KJ Hamler as well, likely one of the fastest players in this draft. They add this to an offense that has Cortland Sutton and Noah Fant already. It seems that other than Sutton and Fant, I really like Sutton and Fant for Dynasty. I seem lower than the market by quite a bit on Hamler and Jeudy specifically. How are you feeling about Hamler and Jeudy?
It's tricky because I think you want to like these guys. I do. The whole Alabama depth chart there is so interesting because it's so crowded. The guys are so good. You have Tua in there with the top five draft pick, even with him coming off of the injury. And, you know, these guys scored a lot of points. They didn't score 100 points a game. And at some point, you know, you're wondering who really was making that all happen. It would be a surprise if all of those guys could actually be as good as they seem. And I think that Jeudy perhaps being the player that I wanted to avoid, not because I think that he's going to be a bad NFL player or is going to be a bust, but just that there's a tiny bit more risk than his name suggests, certainly in contrast to CeeDee Lamb, for example. I think it's really easy to move him down into the range now where you just wouldn't have to worry about that. At the same time, when he was at the 109 in our draft yesterday, I was looking to move up and perhaps make that pick because, especially when you have a prospect who's looked at as having that much upside by everyone, then, you know, if he has a couple of good games to start the season, he quickly jumps up into that 101 value in terms of what you could then trade him for. So it's hard for me to sell these guys too much. We talked on the site this week about selling Courtland Sutton simply because you can probably get so much for him that you might want to trade him anyway, right? Going back to our discussion at the beginning, one of the things that I try and force myself to do, and one of the ways that I might be a little bit different than what you see from most dynasty players, we've all had that situation where we send out the trade offer and we get the notice back that, no, that's someone who's off limits. That's a foundation player for me. Certainly, I have a lot of Christian McCaffrey. Very difficult to trade him. However, right. All of the guys, you know, I'm looking at these guys, even the foundation players, and saying, I have to force myself to make sure I keep moving some of these people so I can stay young, so I can stay a little bit diversified. You know, you go through the first couple of seasons and, you know, you have McCaffrey at this great value after his rookie season. So you load up on him everywhere. You have Sutton a couple of different times that first season and a half where he's a very good value. You load up on him everywhere. And then once the value really spikes, and certainly McCaffrey, number one overall, you have someone like Sutton now, who I think is a very clear-cut top 20 guy. I think you could have argued for him as an outside kind of top 10 guy before this draft. If you can still sell him because people are looking at the rookies as being the people who lost value, then that's something I would look at doing, even though I think that he has the chance to go on and be Andre Johnson, right? Certainly if Drew Locke is any good, he has a chance to be an absolute monster, but I think you have to try and force yourself to sell a little bit anyway. It is going to be a fascinating offense. I think it's exciting almost for Chiefs fans because the Chiefs were dominating the AFC West so completely in 2019 that they actually didn't have to be as fun. You know, they weren't at that passing circus so much during the regular season. We got to see that more in the playoffs because they had those weird games where they managed to get behind. And then you see what they can do. I'm hoping that what the Broncos did here and what the Raiders sort of tried to do will be more successful maybe than people are giving them credit for. And we can have these unbelievable, marvelous, magical shootouts going forward. And certainly KJ Hamler, he's got a better prospect lab score than those guys we just talked about. He may be better than Jalen Reagor. Certainly is going to be a lot less expensive because of how crowded this depth chart is. So I think that buying these guys when you can, certainly if you're going to get them at some discounts based on how crowded this is, you know, that tight end situation, very frustrating as well. Drafted Albert yesterday in the fourth round, which seems crazy. On the other hand, I mean, how is he going to score any points in the first couple of years?
Exactly, right? I think that is a big thing that we are seeing with this offense, which is just, you know, how is it possible that Drew Locke is going to keep Noah Fant and Courtland Sutton and Jerry Jeudy? I don't think it's possible for all of these guys to be, you know, really great fantasy assets. I would say, though, if they are just exciting and fun, right? Like if they just come out and they're scoring 28 points a game and they're throwing the ball all over, like even if specifically it's not happening yet for Hamler, or maybe Jeudy starts slow while Sutton and Fant are having great seasons, or, you know, I think that it's going to be kind of a boat that rises all tides, sort of like how, like, in terms of raw volume, Mecole Hardman did not have the most amazing season ever. He ran incredibly good on touchdowns, and he was really efficient when he got the ball. But Mecole Hardman is a really valuable asset in Dynasty right now, despite not having a super projectable target volume at the moment.
Definitely. And, you know, we're seeing the explosion of formats that are a lot of fun and allow us to do some different things. Certainly, I think almost everyone now wants to be in super flex. They want to be in tight end premium. We've had the opportunity here to be in a best ball format, which is also something that is increasing as people want to play more. But no one wants to feel the stress of having to set 50 starting lineups on a Sunday morning. And when you look at a Hardman, I think that he's going to grow into volume and going to be an absolute star. You and I, you are bidding a little bit of a bidding war over him. Obviously, our Kansas City homerism coming into play a little bit there. But when you look at these Broncos guys, if you are in a dynasty best ball league, then I like them more because they are going to have some games when they score some big points, both the team in general and these specific players.
Yeah, I mean, and that's actually a great note, is anyone who is trying to get through their quarantine boredom, I would really recommend just joining more dynasty best ball leagues. It is just one of the absolute best formats to undergo. It's so much fun, all these drafts. I mean, let's talk a little bit about the dynasty auction. There's been a bunch of podcasts on the Sports Grid Fantasy Football feed about it. We've talked about it on this show before. How did you enjoy that auction experience? And kind of what was your strategy going in, and how did your strategy change as you saw some of those astronomical prices for guys on the first couple days?
Yeah, there's no comparison. You look at doing a draft versus doing an auction, and doing a draft is like, you know, watching your favorite movie. Doing an auction is like watching your favorite, 50 episode television show. I mean, there's no comparison in terms of the amount of enjoyment there. And you can have the guys that you want. If you don't come down with the roster you want in the end, you have nobody to blame for yourself. You could keep bidding higher, right? I really wanted McCaffrey in this draft or Barkley in this draft, bid very high on both of those guys, and they still went higher. And you mentioned the tactics going in and then what happened as the draft went along. And traditionally what we see, and this is a little bit less the case in slow auctions, but still does happen, is you get those very best values for the first handful of guys that go off. And then people see that, they kind of set their boards to that a little bit. They realize they need to also get in on the action, and that next wave is very expensive. And then you move through the draft, or the auction, kind of based on that. What we saw here was that people understood this idea of the early values, and we're not going to let that happen. They also understood the value of getting, these very best players. And so they were incredibly expensive. And as a result of that, I kept looking at what the players were going for based on where I had them, sort of adding the values together. And I couldn't see how there was going to be money left for the sort of deep, interesting middle tier. And at a certain point, I had to hold off, couldn't get those guys I wanted at the top. Really sort of tried to emphasize getting the quarterbacks, because in a super flex league, they're very difficult to get if you don't come down with them in the original draft or auction. Certainly, I like to try and get some of the old guys cheap, but if they're not going to be inexpensive, it can be tricky. And you don't want to necessarily have to use your first round rookie picks on quarterbacks in the future. And so if you can get those guys who are in their 20s and not have to continually be churning, that has a value too. So I tried to get some of the foundation quarterbacks and then found that I had to really wait because the player values were so high, and it was exciting. I mean, you look at all these big names going off the board at these astronomical prices, and you can feel the enthusiasm. Certainly you don't have to worry about price enforcement with the values we were getting in our league.
Yeah, that is definitely true. So I realized that things had just kind of gone off the rails, and I have a multi year cleanup on my hands. But I have Patrick Mahomes, I have Clyde Edwards-Helaire. So I think one of the interesting things that this draft showed, the quarantine auction that we did, the second round this year in rookie drafts is just full of guys who are going to be multi-year assets, right? Like this has to be one of the best second rounds that we have ever had.
It is. And certainly one of the values of the Superflex is that it lengthens or it deepens what you're looking at in terms of players who are valuable or are meaningful. And I think that when you're making trades, or you're planning for what you want to do draft-wise, looking at that second round in a Superflex league, you're going to get a lot of values. 2020 even more than usual. I think that what we're going to see is that some of these names are actually pretty overvalued, but it's a fun draft, like we talked about at the beginning, because you can get your guys, and certainly you have a chance to really hit your targets. And if you are right this year, it could completely change your team, because there are players in that second round whom you could be very, very, very right about.
Yeah. All right. So some deeper guys for you. Your favorite day three running back is who? You know, could be prospect, could be landing spot. Who are some of the gems for you from the 2020 NFL draft?
Well, it was interesting. There weren't that many deep running backs, it didn't seem like, this season, but there were a couple of guys I really like. Eno Benjamin and Joshua Kelly were number one and number three, respectively, in backfield dominator rating, one of the cool pieces that Blair does. Again, a metric you can look at and help you beat the draft. They both have a little bit of athleticism. Kelly with the barely sub 4.5 40. You know, Benjamin, almost all of the rhetoric around him, especially after the fall, seems to be about the negatives. When this is a guy who has a 39-inch vertical, a sub-7 3-cone, his number one comp in our Combine Explorer is Aaron Jones, and they are almost exactly the same when you look at their size, their testing. Now, I mean, Aaron Jones was unlikely to do what he's done, but he was a very undervalued prospect when he got to Green Bay, certainly now one of the best running backs in the entire NFL. For me as well on Benjamin, I love this fit here because Kenyon Drake, he's one of those guys who could be even a top three running back this year. You look at what that Arizona Cardinals offense is going to do, certainly what they hope to do, and the amount of points they score, you know, could be off the charts. You look at what Drake specifically did over the last month, and it's easy to see how he could score an avalanche of points. At the same time, we're still talking about a guy who never was really liked by any team or any coaches until just down the stretch there in Arizona. But it doesn't even have to be anything that's wrong with him. We know that injuries happen to running backs. It's very unfortunate. If something like that happens, Benjamin goes in there. Yeah, there are so many ways in which he's so similar to the running back that the Chiefs drafted in the first round, right? And so you're looking at another running back in an offense that is absolutely perfect for fantasy scoring. So I think he has to be my favorite day three guy. Is that absolutely crazy? Where do you fall on Benjamin?
No, I mean, Benjamin, I think people forget, this is a guy who, like, if you went back and looked at early 2020 mock drafts after the NFL draft in 2019 got done, you would have seen Benjamin being discussed as, you know, one of the better players in college football. He had 1,600 rushing yards, 16 rushing touchdowns, 35 receptions, 263 receiving yards. I mean, he was a stud at Arizona State in 2018, and, you know, he was just dominating that backfield in touches. Really, no other running back on that roster had more than 45 carries, and he had a bad final season. But, I mean, first of all, it was not his senior season, right? Only a junior season. Still ran for 1,000 yards. And Arizona State was just – they just were not as good, right? They just were a worse team with Jaden Daniels at quarterback than they were with Manny Wilkins from the year before. So I don't even really think that I don't even really think that you can – hold it against him per se, right? Like, I think that it's a scenario where he became an undervalued asset, but if he becomes a really good NFL player, are people really going to be surprised?
I would certainly hope not. We see a lot of things talking about him being a third down back or someone who is, you know, very much just for specific situations. And then you mentioned, I mean, his work at Arizona State, and I think it calls that a little bit into question. The other thing here with running backs, I'm not as concerned with the big draft falls as I am with wide receivers. Certainly it's not great, but when you end up in a depth chart that makes a lot of sense for you and you have the athleticism, you have that production in your background. Certainly, you know, you talk about him and his breakout compared to some of the guys who were picked much earlier than he was is earlier, which that's actually a positive sign, not a negative. You know, we're looking at the bigger picture in terms of his overall career there. It's always a little bit of a concern when the NFL GMs don't agree. At the same time, you know, when you look at day three NFL drafts over the past 10 years, it's really hard to fathom what the GMs have been doing, because they consistently take people who were not as productive in college and expect that to work out. And yet you pull up the running back prospect lab, you pull up different methods for doing player comps, like our box score scout, the other wonderful things that are out there on the internet. And it's just, it's so completely concrete that the guys who were good college players become good NFL players. The people who did not produce in college, they really struggle. And that's, I mean, that's very intuitive. I mean, why would we expect it to be any different? And so, you know, he's somebody I really like getting there. It'll be interesting to see where fantasy players end up being on him, because I certainly think there's a little bit of that. The letdown is so great when people have been anticipating him for the last 18 months or so. And now we get hit with this realization that the NFL doesn't see him as being a guy who is anything more than like a third stringer. You know, certainly there's a lot of discussion of Chase Edmonds being someone who's well ahead of him. I like Edmonds. Certainly that could work out. We saw him have some good games. He has some good athleticism. I think that Benjamin will end up being the guy here if something does happen to Drake, or both of those guys could score points. So the price on him will certainly make a difference. Although third round, fourth round, either way, I think you're getting someone who should have been picked much, much earlier.
Yeah, I think that is. I think that seems pretty likely. What about Tyler Johnson? Do you have any the Tyler Johnson wars? Do you have anything to say about what happens when the NFL decides they don't like a player that was as productive as Tyler Johnson was?
So, who would be some of your recent comps on this type of situation? Now, for me, Tyler Johnson is in some ways similar to an Isaiah Ford. He has some similarities to an Alan Lazard. He's got a lot of similarities, I think, to Corey Davis, which after what's happened to Corey Davis, certainly
not good.
Yeah, it doesn't make you feel nearly as good about him there. But what we're looking at here is a guy who was a fantastic college player, definitely seemed to get the feedback that he was not going to be a top draft prospect, stayed for that fourth year. We already discussed what that means in terms of projecting players. And then we find that even then, the NFL doesn't like him at all. And so with Lazard, you have even the clearer situation where this guy is big and athletic, and it was just mind-boggling and frankly ridiculous that he wasn't someone that the NFL liked. I don't know that Johnson has the size or the athleticism to fight his way back through there, but certainly we've seen some players who dropped, not to the same extent, but players like Keenan Allen, who immediately once he gets on an NFL practice field, you're like, oh yeah, I mean, this guy's a star. You know, why was he available where he was available? Is that what you're expecting for Johnson? I guess it's both encouraging and maybe very discouraging that he's with the Buccaneers, and there's not a situation where if he goes out and looks fantastic on the practice field those first couple of weeks that suddenly he moves into the starting lineup. They simply just have too many weapons already.
I would say you'll probably know fairly early on what you have in Tyler Johnson, because if he's able to beat out Scotty Miller and Justin Watson, who have been their day three wide receiver picks for the last 2 years, if he is playing over those guys early on, getting snaps over Cameron Brate early on, I would imagine that is a huge positive, right? Like that's going to indicate that the NFL as a whole was wrong. He probably is not a guy that offers great profit potential though, because at this point, everyone just believes like, oh, well, he's just not going to be that good. So, you know, if he has a 400 yard, 2 touchdown rookie season, I don't think you're immediately going to be able to flip him kind of in the way you would someone like KJ Hamler, or even some of these tight ends that we're going to talk about here in a moment. So if, you know, Dalton Keene, Devin Asiasi, Albert O, if these guys are productive, if they play as rookies, you're going to be able to turn them for a profit right away.
Yeah, I think you could see that. So you're suggesting the exposure that we all had to Tyler Johnson may actually hold him down. In that context, there are some other names on day three that I like, but certainly wouldn't necessarily expect them to end up being anything simply because the deck is somewhat stacked against them at this point, but maybe don't have that same level of exposure. And if they did get off to a fast start, might see themselves really rise. I have Gabriel Davis, Gandy Golden, Isaiah Hodgins, Quez Watkins. Those are the other guys I'm really interested in. If they came out and had a good start, certainly if Davis or Hodgins were clearly the better guy there in Buffalo and were able to make a move maybe on the veteran receivers there, is that a situation where you could see their values actually skyrocketing in a way that Johnson's can't?
100%. Yeah, I think that the skyrocketing value for Tyler Johnson is it probably involves a Mike Evans or Chris Godwin injury, and it involves him playing more as a rookie than Bruce Arians or Tom Brady wants him to, right? Like, and it sucks because I like Tyler Johnson. I thought he was just a great player in college, and I was mystified by how far. Well, not mystified, because guys that are not that athletic, you know, they rarely become you know, great NFL players. But it seems weird to me that someone who I thought was so great in college with such great production, like Tyler Johnson, is just not ready to be a star in the NFL.
And certainly not rich is what the NFL seems to be telling it with the move here.
Yeah, that is definitely true. Okay, so I wanted to go ahead and end here with a big strategic question, which is the workhorse running back. It, you know, it really does seem like it's coming to the end in the NFL. Right now, by my count, we have fewer than 10. We have CMC, we have Zeke, we have Dalvin Cook, and Saquon. Those are, I think, the guys we just say, those are unimpeachable. Those guys are getting 80% of the work in the backfield. Then we have, in the next year, Joe Mixon, Josh Jacobs, Miles Sanders, and Alvin Kamara. To me, that is really the only list of guys of workhorse running backs. How does that change the setup for you of how Dynasty works, of how fantasy football as a whole works?
It's interesting because we've done a lot of work with Mike Beer's Roster Construction Explorer with some of the different best ball formats. And it's very, very clear that specifically in that format, but I think it's very easily generalizable to the other types of formats that you might be playing, that you want to get one of these workhorse backs, and not necessarily just for the touches, but the touches are high value, right? So we've moved into a time period in the NFL where running backs are actually scoring more points again, or the top guys are scoring more points again. And it's a very different kind of question about do you want to expose yourself to running back injuries if a guy is scoring 25 to 30 points a game than if he's scoring, you know, 15 to 17 points a game. It completely changes the calculation there. Your roster ideally would have one of these stars. And for me, the stars would be probably even a more limited list of that. Not really the people who are just getting the touches, but the people who are turning those touches into massive points. So if you can get a McCaffrey, a Barkley, a Cook, a Kamara, then I really like to get those four guys at the top. And then certainly what we should do, and Blair's put together a tool that's demonstrated this, the Fantasy Douche put together tons of stuff that would show this, is certainly still the case, even after last season, where those running back dead zone guys actually had a very good year, both in terms of points and in terms of staying healthy, that you do not want running backs in that second round to fifth, sixth, seventh round range, right? So we do sort of a modified approach here with zero running back, where because of the massive number of points those top guys can score, if you have access to them, if you're in a point in the draft where you can get them, then you should take them and then go wide receiver, wide receiver, wide receiver, wide receiver, wide receiver, wide receiver. And one of the things that we see is that because of the dynamic you're talking about, it opens up depth charts to where there are going to be lots of players who still will be available to score for you. If you end up in a league where drafters are still vacuuming up all of those guys, even if you have to go down to a very low level running back, you're still going to come out ahead, because the running backs, I mean, the wide receivers in that range from approximately 10 to approximately 70 or 80, they just hammer the running backs in terms of total points. And you want to take advantage of that. But I think that one of the things that we see again after this draft, and with so many of the situations that might have become bell cow situations, but people didn't really expect that, and now they know that they're not. You know, you look at a situation in Buffalo where I think both of those guys are very interesting. You look at a situation in Green Bay where perhaps it hurts Aaron Jones a little bit, but AJ Dillon, certainly if you're in a best ball league and can get some of those touchdowns, you don't have to pick the week. Very interesting. A lot of situations too, where maybe you do have even multiple players who might be in on the receiving touches now. And so with that being the case, that's the way that I definitely want to build my rosters.
Yeah. Those are very good words of wisdom. What is your game plan for the 2020 NFL season? Are you going to be going as heavy on the main event, all of these leagues? If we don't have training camp, we don't have rookie OTAs, I feel like there will be less information and probably more of an edge in handicapping the 2020 NFL season than many seasons in recent history.
Yeah, I think I'll probably play it about the same way. Certainly, we'd like to get positive information, much more than even just for fantasy football, certainly positive information for the country over the next couple of months that show us going in a very positive direction. If that happens, the NFL certainly seems like they are ready to put some things in place that will allow some sort of season. And if we have less information, then I think tactics become even more important. And certainly that's what I think you should emphasize from the beginning. There's all kinds of research to show just how difficult it is to pick players. Now, I'm not saying don't do that. There are all kinds of guys you like. There are all kinds of guys that I like. We feel very strongly about those players. In many cases, we like them because they have been productive, and we don't have to go out on a limb and say, oh, well, if everything changes, then this guy will be good. I mean, no, you want those guys who have demonstrated not just talent, but skill for a long time, right? Loading up on those players, somewhat straightforward, but picking guys is the fun part. So it's not like we were going to say, oh, you know, don't worry about picking players. I don't actually like to do the thing where I have a lot of diversity. I tend to be a little bit more concentrated in terms of the guys I like, because in any given year, there aren't that many players who are extreme values. And so you do want to be heavy on those guys. But tactics are going to come into play with the less information we have. And so certainly, I think following people who discuss that and making sure that you're in position to take advantage of some of the structural elements of your league is going to be something that's important in a season like this. Would you say that the lack of information is going to be a key interesting aspect of this? Or, I mean, is there a scenario where we could almost have business as usual by the time training camps roll around?
So I don't think that we are going to have business as usual. I think that there is actually a scenario where this season kind of plays out like 2011, which was, you know, the Eli Manning, Matthew Stafford, 5,000-yard seasons, the crazy passing seasons. I also think that another possible scenario is that the league plays out like the XFL this year, where the offensive lines aren't gelling, the quarterbacks don't understand the system, the coaches are frustrated, and the football is a lot uglier, and teams that have continuity, I think, are just going to have a huge advantage this year, right? Like, I just think that it is true that continuity is going to be huge. So teams like the Chiefs, obviously going to be very interested in that, but like teams that are not adding rookie players at key skill positions, tight end, wide receiver, running back, those are going to be situations that I am very interested in investing in. I also agree that it's going to be a big year for strategy and for adapting on the fly, you know, adjusting your waiver bids, maybe winning the flex is going to be very different this year if scoring is different. And, it's just going to be a year, I think, that rewards hard work and being able to adjust on the fly.
And I don't think that we would wish this on, you know, certainly the big picture things we wouldn't wish on anybody. We don't think we would wish on the NFL to have bad football. It certainly seems like this would contribute to the Kansas City Chiefs probably having as much or more advantage in the AFC. With the NFC, teams I think are stronger. It's going to make it much more difficult for the 49ers to get back than for the Chiefs to get back. The AFC West, we've seen them make a lot of moves to try and close that gap again. but it sounds like you think that could be very difficult, at least in 2020. It might be more of a 2021 phenomenon in terms of those teams getting back and really being competitive.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there is, like, the Broncos are actually a great example of a team that they're going to have a ton of they're going to have a ton of very talented players. I do not know how that is going to work out for them in terms of getting them ready. Cause like, I mean, even think about it. The first time Jerry Jeudy might get into a practice with Drew Lock might be a month before they have to go play an NFL game. Like that is terrifying, right? That should be very terrifying for Jeudy to think about, because playing in the NFL is hard. It's not an easy job.
And it makes it, I think, interesting for tactics on rookie drafts, which obviously is the most timely thing right now, where that second round we discussed, it's so intriguing. That first round, I have almost all of those guys losing some value over last weekend. And then you look at, is there a scenario, I guess my question would be, where we have this draft that is so deep and so talented, and yet I think the first round is both difficult to determine order, certainly tricky in terms of how much those running backs are going to contribute right away. And then you mentioned how hard it might be for all of those rookies. Is there a situation where you'd be tempted to have this be your one year that you actually trade out of, especially the first round of the rookie draft, even though overall the draft is very talented?
So this is why I would not. The 2021 class might be one of the worst rookie drafts that we see, because we might not get good data on the incoming class. So we might get partial games, we might get no games, we might get no combine. I think there are a lot of scenarios where 2021 ends up being a giant question mark, right? Where we just have no clue what's going on with these guys, and we're really relying on a ton of data from when they were sophomores. Also last thing, it's so great having your ear to talk about all this stuff. The last thing I want to ask is, what do you think the proper strategy will be if players like Travis Etienne, Chuba Hubbard, some of these guys decide, you know what, I actually don't want to go back and play college football my final season. I'd like to enter the supplemental draft. Do you think, like, first of all, do you have any ideas on what some of your leagues might do in that scenario? And then kind of what do you think is the proper way to react in that situation?
It's really tricky. I don't know how the NFL and college will work with this. It certainly seems like there are some rules in place to where those guys wouldn't be eligible just because there were some things that came up. But going to the idea of what happens if they are there, that's so tricky, because the free agent budgets, and certainly, we hope everyone's playing in leagues where you're bidding as opposed to having waiver orders, but they're not really set up to deal with this big influx of superstars. And so, you're going to have a lot of trading to try and get more than 100% in terms of your free agent dollars. And simply having those guys in that process, I think, is not what people are going to feel good about. You might even do a supplemental draft for your league as well, where you have a draft order. People have to decide if they're going to use their first round picks from 2021 to make selections on those guys. And if they do, then they lose them. Now, for a few of those names you've mentioned, I think it'll be fairly straightforward to make those picks and lose your 2021 pick, but that might be another way to do it. Have you run across some interesting approaches that are being thrown out there?
Well, one of the ideas that I saw, I believe Curtis Patrick from RotoViz threw this one out. This, it actually might've been Scott Fish. I can't remember, but one of them effectively said, you know, the way that we can, one idea would be that it's done in a sort of bidding system, but with your future picks. So you say, I will use my 2021 first on Travis Etienne. And then someone else says, okay, I will also use my 2021 first on Travis Etienne. And then it's like a bidding system with future picks, maybe hybridized with FAB dollars. I think the best way to do it, well, So if we only get three or four guys, I think the best way to do it is just with fab dollars that would be available and they get added, like a rookie. If we get 10, 15, 20 guys who are all going to be, you know, NFL players, I think that you effectively just set up an in-league auction where everyone is given, you know, $1,000 auction dollars, and it's basically treated as its own rookie draft, but as an auction. So everyone is on even playing, like an even playing field.
Do you have any thoughts on some of these guys who might be eligible, and looking at it in terms of why they went back, how it influences your ranking of them? Again, looking at it from the perspective of the four-year players, there are some real concerns about how they translate. And if scouts were telling them after their junior season that you're not going to be picked as high as you want, that that's actually a pretty big flag, red flag, even though some of those players, I mean, I've been making moves to add Etienne and Hubbard onto as many Debbie squads as I can, because in many ways, I felt like they were the superior running back prospects in this draft had they declared.
Right. So, I mean, I think Chuba Hubbard and Etienne both would have had arguments to being some of the best, you know, just some of the best overall prospects. You know, in terms of guys who should not have gone back to school, I think Tylan Wallace from Oklahoma State, Chuba Hubbard's teammate, he's one who I think that the reason he went back was just that it was such a deep wide receiver class, and he probably got some feedback that he was going to be like a third or fourth round pick. I probably would have just went if I was him. But a lot of the guys who are premium 2021 assets, they're guys like Jamar Chase, Rondale Moore, Jalen Waddle, Amon-Ra St. Brown, who is someone that you and I were talking about trading in the Kitchen Cinco League. Like it's a lot of guys who, you know, they just would not have been eligible anyways, basically.
Right. And with those wide receivers, it's interesting because this draft at wide receiver, very deep. I'm not convinced it had the top end guys. And certainly it didn't seem like the NFL GMs. It's always that question when you have a little bit of a deeper draft. Did those receivers not go in the top 10 because the teams didn't need receiver? Did they not go in the top 10 to top 15 because they didn't believe that they were top 15 caliber prospects? Or did they not go that early because they simply liked some of the people later? Certainly we saw the 49ers pass and then immediately move back in for a guy that we assume they had similarly graded. The next draft seems to have perhaps the very top end guys at wide receiver. And so in terms of moving into that draft, that doesn't sort of grab you at all in terms of, even if they don't have a season, that those would be guys you might want more than some of these players we just saw?
I mean, getting the information would be huge, right? Like I just think that the more valuable thing is having the information. I mean, I think I would be bummed out if I was forced to make all of these bids on, you know, on Rondale Moore, on Najee Harris, on Max Borgie with not all of the available information, right? Like I want to be able to contextualize these guys as much as possible. And I the more I think about it, I actually think the most likely outcome is that I think that even if the NFL happens, I don't know if a college football season is going to happen if they don't have kids on campus. And that is definitely going to lead to 2021 drafts being just a big giant guest festival, right? Because it's just impossible to make, you know, great projections for players with one or two seasons of information.
Yeah, certainly having the information is good. I do think that some of these young wide receivers have been so good that we could make an argument of, well, is it actually going to hurt us more than it helps us? You know.
Give me Jalen Waddle right now. Give me Jalen Waddle on an NFL team. He's ready, right? Yeah, I agree there.
So, yeah, it certainly, I think moving in and out of rookie drafts, comparing those rookies to the veteran counterparts, trying to figure out how you can get in without overpaying, you know, that's part of the tricky part, because some of the times, by the time that you get in for that 105, you're like, I just gave up like a third of my team. That can't possibly work out in my favor. So just an absolute blast what's going on right now.
Yeah, it is. I think that the uncertainty of the 2020 season and the 2021 draft and everything, I think that it adds, just there is a huge element of not guesswork, but it's another element of strategy, right? And people are kind of thinking about things in you know, what is going to benefit me the most, and which is fascinating. So Sean, thank you very much for your time. Always a pleasure to chat fantasy football with you. For my money, you are probably the best fantasy football player that there is. You definitely showed that in the quarantine auction. What are you working on right now? What are some of the next things we can see from you over at RotoViz?
Well, a little bit more with the wide receiver prospect lab scores. Going to look at actually our quarantine rookie draft, compare that to the, I tried to do a little bit of an experiment this time around, did a live 3-round mock rookie draft, kind of as the draft was going, was moving those guys as each player was picked. Going to compare our draft to that draft to see sort of where my projections were right, maybe where they're a little bit wrong, or maybe where I think there could be some values. So looking at that for folks who are going to be doing rookie drafting over the next couple of weeks, and then looking at how some of these guys fit in to the NFL. Are there some opportunities to take advantage on the veteran side? You know, are there some sleepers? Obviously, we all have our people. It would have been interesting, you know, if we had 3 hours, I'd love to hear, you know, where you are on Steven Sims after Washington still has.
I still believe guys that fast who play that young, they end up scoring points.
Well,
I still believe.
If you could be a solid player at Kansas, then you got to be a solid player anyway.
Exactly. Very, very good point. Yeah.
But Davis, I appreciate so much you having me on. You've always been one of my favorites. Our group that started RotoViz there, so close to my heart. And I appreciate you sort of taking the risk or taking the hit or whatever, however it works out, to have someone on the show who is not on Twitter. I know that's not particularly easy. So I really appreciate it. It's so much fun talking with you.
Beautiful. Sean, thank you for the time. Everyone go read his articles on RotoViz. You can follow him on Twitter, even though he doesn't tweet. You can listen to his podcast if you just search Overtime or RotoViz on wherever you listen to podcasts. It's very easy to find. And we will be back soon with more content for you guys.